Thank you, Drew, and good afternoon to all of you. You all had a good week. Welcome back, Aaron and Jake Trone, visiting us for Thanksgiving. It's nice to see them again. Well, as you are probably all aware, the world has been a very interesting place these last couple of weeks. It's been unnerving and has been changing daily. When we look at back in our lives, all of our lives, we've seen many, many changes that have taken place and are probably going to continue to take place. If we were to go back into the world about only 25 or 30 years ago, those people from 25 or 30 years ago would probably not understand or recognize what we live with today. Take, for example, communications. In this modern world that we live in, we live with Snapchats, we live with instant messages, we live with texts, we live with tweets and retweets. We have emoticons, we have lowercase letters that mean words, and who knows what else. If some of this makes absolutely no sense to you, don't feel bad, you're in good company. I'm still trying to learn what all this means as we evolve into this. People that are like half my age get this stuff, I don't get most of it. You know, today the personal handwritten letter has pretty much fallen out of favor. I don't know that many of us in this room have probably sat down and written a letter, licked a stamp, put it on an envelope, licked the envelope, stuck it in the envelope, and put it in the mail, which is known today as snail mail, because it takes so long to get there. But you know, for centuries, this form of communication, handwritten letters, was the primary form to communicate with one another around the world. It was the norm for everybody. Nobody had all this other stuff. Because these letters, these handwritten letters that people would write, sometimes it would take days, sometimes it would take weeks, and sometimes it would take months, and even at moments, it took maybe up to a year to get a letter to go from point A to point B somewhere in the world. And because of this, people knew time would pass between the time they wrote the letter and the time the recipient would receive the letter. So they took a lot of effort. They made a lot of conscious decisions. They really put their heart and being into what they were writing because they knew there was no way to correct it once it was sent. What they put down on paper is what the recipient would get. It's what the recipient would receive. It's what the recipient would understand. There was no do-overs. There was no edits. There was no changing. Once the letter was sent, it was gone. It would convey what the author had put down on paper, and that alone. Turn with me, if you would, to the book of Hebrews, chapter 11. Hebrews, chapter 11. Sermonette that Dirk gave last week prompted this sermon this week, because he made a couple of comments during the sermonette that I thought, you know, this would be worth looking into deeper. When you think about it, with the exception of the four Gospels and the book of Acts, that is what quite a bit of the New Testament actually is. It's a series of well-written letters. Letters that were written to either individuals or letters that were written to churches, groups of people. When we look at it and we analyze it, the apostles who wrote these letters had one primary motive in their minds and in their hearts. They were trying to communicate the truth. Whatever it was they felt needed to be communicated, they put it down on paper, if you will, or papyrus, or whatever it is that they used to write on back then, and they put their heart into it. They really thought about what they were saying because they knew there could be misinterpretations by people reading what they were putting down. And more importantly, they were also concerned about how that truth would be applied to the lives of those who read the letter. Many of these letters, which today are known as epistles, had a two-part approach to them if you look at most, if not all of them, and analyze them. Part one was they would put forth some concept of Christian doctrine. They would elaborate on it. They would discuss it. They would detail it. They would explain it. Maybe the explanation came directly from Jesus Christ if Paul was writing it. Maybe it came from some other source if one of the other apostles were writing it. But they would try to put down a concept of Christian doctrine to begin with. And point number two in the epistle, and you can go through all the epistles and you'll find this theme pretty much holds up in almost all of them.
Secondarily, there would be an exhortation about how to apply that doctrinal principle in the lives of the recipients. Almost every single epistle is like that. When we look at the book of Hebrews, we can also see this two-part delineation, proposing a doctrinal principle and then proposing how that principle can be applied to people's lives. When we look at chapters 1 through 10 of the book of Hebrews, we can see clearly that they discuss the doctrinal supremacy of Jesus Christ. All 10 chapters basically address that point and that issue. But in chapters 11, 12, and 13, we can see a turn where the author, whom I believe was the Apostle Paul, turns the attention now from the doctrinal principle, which was the supremacy of Jesus Christ, to the readers themselves. He wants the readers to now take the premises that he set forth, and he wants the readers to understand what that premise has to do with them and their lives. Maybe as they were writing it, they were asking the question, like I believe Paul was, what should your life look like in the context of what we just read about who Jesus Christ is and what he did for us in our lives? How should we be living our lives knowing that that's what's transpired? And that's basically what the first 10 chapters of the book of Hebrews talks about. Once we get to Hebrews chapter 12, we will see the application side of this thing that I was talking about, of this truth being given through the first 10 chapters. Chapter 11 is sort of a transitional chapter between the first 10 and the last two. And the first 10 chapters will be this link, this bridge, if you will, from the first 10 to 12 and 13. Here in Hebrews 11, there's something that is said about what was going on with the lives of these people. In Hebrews 11, verses 1 through 31, which we have read many, many times, Paul describes and gives descriptions about many individuals throughout history who have exemplified the concept of faith. As you know, Hebrews 11 is known as the faith chapter. So what he does is he elaborates in first 31 verses about individual after individual and concept after concept as it relates to faith. Let's take a peek at what they were able to accomplish, these individuals that he was talking about. Let's take a peek at what they were able to accomplish as a result of their faith-related relationship with God and Jesus Christ. Let's pick it up today in Hebrews 11, beginning in verse 32. Hebrews 11, verse 32. And what more shall I say, Paul asks, as he's elaborated on all these other individuals' life, for the time would fail me to go on and tell you more about Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, also of David and Samuel and the prophets. He said, I could go on and on and on and on, but I don't need to do that. I've already given you a good sampling of what these individuals are like. Then let's look at what was accomplished by these individuals through their faith. Verse 33, these individuals, who through faith subdued kingdoms, who through faith worked righteousness, who through faith obtained promises because of this faith relationship that they developed with God. Things started happening. They stopped the mouths of lions through faith. They quenched the violence of fire with faith. They escaped the edge of the sword. Out of weakness, they were made strong through faith. They became valiant in battle against insurmountable odds at times because of their faith. Turned flight of the armies of the aliens. They actually caused individuals who were swarming them to turn around and go the other direction. I think of Gideon. I mean, it's just a phenomenal, phenomenal story, Gideon's army. And one of those things is just, it's like you can't help but weave that into sermons on an ongoing basis because it's such a powerful story. This is all quite impressive of and by itself. I think you would all agree. But then Paul also summarizes what these individuals, because of their faith, were willing and able to contend with in their life as they struggled with their faith, as they went through their life, just like you and me and everybody else struggles with life. Listen to what they were able to accomplish because of their faith. Verse 35, women received their dead raised to life again. Others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. They were willing to go ahead and die because they knew there was a better resurrection coming for them. Still others had trial of mockings and scourgings, yes, and of chains and imprisonment. Some were stoned. Some were sawn in two. They were able to take it. They were able to handle it, and they were able to do it because of their faith. They were tempted. They were slain by the sword. They wandered around in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented. You know, you can read those passages that I just read, those two or three verses, and you can think, oh man, that's just horrible, 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 horrible. God's pointing out that it's wonderful that these individuals had developed such a relationship with Him that they were capable of stepping forward and allowing things like that to happen to them, and they didn't come apart at the seams. They didn't lose their faith. They didn't turn down another path to make life easier. They kept moving forward because they knew that promise that was made to them was real. They knew that that commitment that God and Jesus Christ had made to them was real. They knew that it was going to be accomplished. And they had so deeply implanted in their mind and in their visionary process that the only thing they would see probably is when they were going through these horrible, horrible things was the glory of what's coming in the future. Because they had developed such a deep, deep, deep-rooted relationship of faith with God and with Jesus Christ. And then he goes on in verse 38 and he makes an interesting comment. He says, of whom the world is not worthy. What's he saying there? He said, you know what? These individuals, when they've established that kind of faith, that kind of relationship with God and Jesus Christ, they've learned the supremacy of Jesus Christ. They know who he is in their life. They know the power that he has. They know that the capacity that he has. They know the promises that he's made. And they've lived their life in such a way that they are examples, powerful examples, dramatic examples, inspiring examples. He said the world in which they live, that world's not even worthy to be associated with them. That's what God wants from us. And he says when we get to that point, he says, the world that you live with is not even worthy to be associating with you. They're not even on the same plane as you. They wandered in deserts and mountains, in dens and caves of the earth. And they said, you know what? That's okay. That's okay. I can deal with this because I know what's coming. That interesting statement made by Paul is just powerful when you stop and realize it in the context in which it was made. In whom, of whom, the world is not worthy. They're not worthy to even walk down the same street with you, eat with you, talk with you, fellowship with you, because they haven't developed this kind of relationship. God looks upon these people of faith as very, very special people. See, the calling is the first step. The process to develop the faith is what it's all about. And that's what the book of Hebrews is really all about. Verse 39, he said, and all these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, they still didn't receive the promise. It was only the promise of the promise. It was only the anticipation of the promise that kept them going, because that faith relationship was so deep, so committed, so unbelievably solid and sound. Then we have this, and almost unbelievable statement about us. Verse 40. God having provided something better for us, that they should not be made perfect apart from us. God's trying to tell us here that all these examples of faith that we just read about in Hebrews 11, because they developed that relationship with Jesus Christ, They're being blessed. God's got them on pedestals. God's using them as examples for us. He says, but you know what? There's something actually better for you. Something ahead is actually better for us. He then goes on to address in chapter 12 the how. the how of all of this that he's been talking about. How we can deal with that something better that God has in store and has provided for each and every one of us. Paul knew that the natural tendency of human beings, because he'd lived around them, he probably experienced it in his own life. He knew the natural tendency of human beings was to start out strong and gung-ho and ready to run, ready to go do it, ready to convict the world, ready to commit the world, ready to convert the world. Many of us have felt that way at the first beginning part of our calling and God's relationship with us. They all wanted to start out strong. They also wanted to start out fast. But then through life's issues, they become discouraged with the difficulties and trials start appearing in their lives. But Paul here takes a different view of the Christian life and he shares it with us. He encourages us to focus on laying aside those things that stop us from developing this relationship with Jesus Christ, this relationship with God, this faith, achieving as Christians the way God wants us to. Not unlike the sermon that I just gave on Joy Busters last week. When we look at the very first word of Hebrews chapter 12, we see the perfect link and a reminding review of what we just covered in chapter 11. Hebrews 12, verse 1. And see, let's look at this. Hebrews 12, verse 1. Therefore, stop right there. Therefore, almost predictably, when you read through Hebrews 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11, you almost have to have a therefore there because of the whole concept, because of this transitional change. Paul's trying to convey here is how you should be living in light of all these wonderful examples that God has given you and me to follow. They're human beings just like you. They were human beings just like me. No different. No more blessed. No more converted. No more anything. They were human beings struggling with life just like you and I do. Paul's trying to tell us, look at all these examples we have. And he said, I could go on and on and on about this. He said, God wants you to look at these examples and let these examples be an inspiration to you. He then goes on showing how to keep moving forward positively in our spiritual lives. It's essential. I remember when I was in high school, a long time ago, I decided to start running track. The reason I decided to start running track was I tried football because that's where all the studs were when we were in high school. If you weren't in football, you weren't a stud and you didn't get the girls. I tried football, but I didn't like getting beat up, especially in practice. I thought, this is really stupid, getting the snot kicked out of me, and all I'm trying to do is get ready to go play a football game. This was especially true after I chipped my left shoulder going through a drill that was called Bull in the Middle. Bull in the Middle was this. We weren't wearing shoulder pads. We weren't wearing a helmet. He put one man in the middle of the entire rest of the team. The one man had to break out of the ring by barreling himself into the other players. And when you do that, sometimes you get hurt. And I got hurt. I chipped my left shoulder. And I've paid for that ever since. And I thought, this is ridiculous. I'm not doing this ever again. There's no fun in this. So I decided to go out on the track field. And the coach said, what are you going to run in track? I said, I don't know. He said, why don't you try the 880? I said, okay, that sounds good to me. Now, for those of you that don't know what the 880 was, this is back when it was in yards, not meters, okay? The 880 was basically a half mile. It was two times around the track, two 440s. And it was really sort of a semi-sprint race because you had to keep running fast to get around this track twice. I remember the first time I ran it, after the first lap, I thought I was going to die. I couldn't breathe. Every muscle in my legs ached. My chest hurt. My throat hurt. Everything hurt. And I thought, this is nuts. I can't do this. So I said, what's another race that's shorter? He said, the 100-yard dash. I said, that's mine. And I became a sprinter from there forward. I ran the 100, the 220, and I did long jumping. Here in Hebrews 12 and verse 1, Paul equates our life as Christians to that of a race that we must finish. We can't quit after one lap, and we need to finish strong. Hebrews 12, verse 1 again. Therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, referring back to Hebrews chapter 11, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. If you think about it, Paul is telling us that those mentioned in Hebrews 11 essentially are speaking to us today. Maybe those group of individuals in Hebrews 11 are saying something like this to us. God is faithful. God will provide you with the strength, the encouragement, and everything else you need to endure the race he's got you in. It's as though Abraham, Joseph, Moses, even Rahab the harlot are saying to us, move out on faith. Trust God. Encouraging us. They're trying to encourage us, like they, that we can in fact run this race of endurance and we can make it finish. We can get to the end of the race. Telling us that we can finish this race. It may seem like you can't, but believe us, you can. These guys are almost like a coach encouraging his team maybe before a game or before a race, saying, you can do this. There is a way that you can finish this race. You can make this happen. Then he gives us ways to accomplish this. One of the other points Paul said is we need to lay aside those things in life that slow us down and or wear us out. Many of us, regretfully, carry around a lot of baggage from our past. Baggage that weighs us down. Baggage that slows us down. Baggage that discourages us. Baggage that gets us thinking we probably aren't going to make it. Paul is trying to tell us, if there's any sin in our lives that will ensnare or trap or deceive us, we need to get rid of it. Similar to, again, to what we heard in the sermon last week. The sin to which Paul is referring when you read it in verse 1 here is somehow linked to chapter 11, the faith chapter. Because this whole thing is stemming from the word therefore. He is referring, this sin that he's referring to that will drag us down and wear us out, is referring to a form of unbelief. He's talking about a lack of faith. Not really believing that God's going to do what God said he was going to do. You've heard me say this probably until you get tired of it. If we really believed deep down into our core, into our being, everything that we read in the Bible about what God says he will do to help us, encourage us, strengthen us, be there for us, we'd never have another worry in the world. Because we would know and really believe God's in charge and God's going to make this thing happen. And I am going to finish this race. When you also look at the word race in verse 1, it reflects the Greek word of race, and that word is agon, A-G-O-N. This is the root word from which we get the word agony. Isn't it interesting? The word used for race in Hebrews 12 and verse 1 is the word agon, indicating this race is going to be a race of agony. It's going to be hard. But we can finish the race. This is acknowledged as a difficult, agonizing at times, the race that we are involved in. We all see it, we all feel it, and we all know it. It's not hard to come to that conclusion. This Christian life is also a long-distance race. It's not a sprint. And it requires commitment to keep training so that we can finish the race. Not like me when I tried to run the 880 and gave up after the first race. I never ran another 880 in my life. So what does Paul tell us to focus on when this race starts to get tough? Because we know it's going to get tough. Let's go to verse 2 of Hebrews 12. He says, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. While we are working at laying aside the weight and the sin that drags us down in our lives, Paul says, you know what? You need to start really looking to Jesus Christ. Looking to him as your leader. Looking to him as the author, the creator of your relationship that you've got going on with God. And the finisher. He has the capacity. He has the ability. He created us. He authored us. He's the one that put it all together, and he's the one that can make it happen. He's the one that can bring us forth to the faith that we can make this whole thing finish. Hold your place in Hebrews 12 here. We're going to come back. And turn over to John chapter 15 with me. John chapter 15. As we saw in Hebrews 11, and as Paul pointed out, we have a great cloud of witnesses encouraging us from the rear, if you will. They're behind us. And then we've got Jesus Christ out in front, leading the way, taking the charge and saying, come on, guys, follow me. Christ has already won the race. He knows it can be done. And he won the race as a human being. He has already crossed the finish line. He knows that feeling, that sensation of crossing that finish line. He's basically telling us, Jesus Christ is, follow me, and you also will finish strong, which is the title of the sermon today, Finishing Strong. So how do we follow Jesus Christ in our life? By following his word in our life. John 15, let's begin here in verse 4. John 15, verse 4. This is part of the dialogue that Christ is giving the disciples after Judas, one of the disciples, asked him this. He said, how he would manifest himself to them and not manifest himself to the rest of the world. Because it was confusing to them. Because if you're going to manifest yourself to us, how is it they're not going to get it too? This is Jesus Christ's answer. John 15, verse 4. He said, abide in me and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit of itself unless it abides in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me. You have to stay attached. He said, there's no other way. He said, you can't go out to a vine. You can't go out to a tree. You can't go out to a bush, cut the branch off, and expect the branch to produce anything. It's going to die. It has to stay connected. He said, I am the vine. You are the branches. We're connected. I am the source of all of your energy. I'm the source of all your nutrition. It comes from the trunk. The vines, the branches, get the source of energy from the trunk. They don't get it from themselves. He said, he who abides in me and I in him bears much fruit because they're attached. You've heard the expression being attached at the hip? That's what Jesus Christ wants. He wants us to be so attached to him, you almost feel like he's bumping into you as you're walking down the street. Think about how different your life would be if that were true. You knew he was right there. And he was walking with you. He listened to you talk. He watched your actions. He watched your behaviors. Maybe once in a while he give you a little jab in the ribs. I don't think that's where you want to go. But he said, that's how I want you to be. I want you to be attached to me. He said, if anyone in verse 6 does not abide in me, he is cast out as a branch and is withered. It's a fact of life. It's going to happen. If we don't stay attached, we can't stay partially attached. What happens if you snip a branch and you sort of cut it half off, but it's still connected but not completely? It's going to die because it doesn't have all of the nutrition it needs. And that's what we need. We need all of the nutrition Jesus Christ can provide. He said, if anyone does not abide in me, is cast out as a branch and is withered. And they gather all these withered ones and throw them into the fire and they're burned. He's talking about the final burning hell fire, Gehenna fire. If you abide in me, and here's the key, and my words abide in you, you will ask what you desire, and guess what? It's going to be done. I've started an experiment in my life recently. I'll show you a little inside peek at me as a human being. I've been concerned about my own personal faith. So what I've started doing is when I wake up at night, and you might think this is really silly and stupid, but it's working for me. I wake up in the middle of the night, and you know sometimes you get up in the middle of the night, you may have to go to the bathroom or get a drink of water, sometimes you go back to bed and you toss and turn and toss and turn, and you can't go back to sleep. Every single time for about the last week and a half or 2 weeks, without exception, make sure that's right. I'm pretty sure that's right. If I'm wrong by one or two, God forgive me, but I'm pretty sure it's 100%. I go back to my bed, I lay down, and I say, okay, God, I need one more hour and 15 minutes of sleep. And I would like to have one more hour and 15 minutes of not frustrating sleep, peaceful sleep, with if you're willing to give me a nice, enjoyable dream. It has happened every single time. Prior to that, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, I forget how long ago I've been doing this, I'd get up in the middle of the night, I'd go back to bed, and I'd toss and turn sometimes for 2 hours before I'd get back to sleep. And that's frustrating. And that's not healthy for you either. But in the last 2 or 3 weeks, that has never happened. I'm getting up at 5:30 in the morning completely refreshed. I don't need naps like I used to take. I used to take a half hour, 45 minutes, an hour nap almost every day because I couldn't get through the day because I was tossing and turning all night long. Why do I share that with you? God says, I want you to trust me. I want you to believe in me. How do we trust and how do we believe in if we don't put him to the test? Again, you might look at that and say, that's silly. Well, you know what? It might be silly to you. It's really working for me. And it's reassuring me that when I go to God and I pray to God and I ask for intervention in my life, I always do it. I try to always do it with his will in mind and remind him of that. And he reminds me of that. And I said, if it's not against your will or whatever, like, I said, I'd really like to have this happen. You know, when I pray to him now, as opposed to 3 weeks ago, I get up with a smile on my face. I know he's listening. If he's willing to do that for me in the middle of the night, if it had happened once or twice or three times, I thought, you know, maybe that's just a fluke. Maybe the first night. It's happened every single night. And sometimes twice a night. I remember one morning I woke up, it was 4 o'clock, and I thought, I need to sleep at least till 5:30. I said, God, I need 90 more minutes. I said, give me peaceful sleep. I woke up at 5:31. He gave me an extra minute. Maybe it took me a minute to get to sleep. I don't know. But Jesus Christ will say, if you abide in me and my words abide in you, you will ask what you desire, and it's going to be done for you. It's real. Really real. By this, my Father is glorified when this kind of relationship starts to develop, that you bear much fruit, so then you will be my disciples. Everything changes. Everything changes when we really believe God. Everything. Every aspect of your being, every aspect of your life changes. Because you know he's listening and you know something is going to happen. It would not be honest of us if we claimed to be Christians and followers of Jesus Christ, as I believe everybody in this room is, and that if we say we love Jesus Christ, if we are not relying on him and letting his words take root in us. He said, let my words become a part of you. That means all of those promises that we start really believing. This means for each and every one of us probably more prayer time with him and our Father in heaven. More study of his word, more applying it in our lives, consciously trying to apply it in our lives and asking for him to increase our faith. But in verse 2 of Hebrews 12, Paul also mentioned joy again, which we talked about in the most recent sermon. Let's reread it here in verse 2. Looking unto Jesus Christ, the author and finisher of our faith, for who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. We would not normally associate joy with pain and suffering, as is mentioned here in Hebrews 12, verse 2. But it did for Christ as he was crucified. Again, hold your place in Hebrews 12 and go over a few pages back to Hebrews 2. Hebrews chapter 2, just a few pages back. In a sense, for Jesus Christ, the cross that he was crucified on represented the finish line of his human race. It was the end of the race. He knew that. His fulfillment of what God the Father had asked him to do for you and me and for the human race, all of mankind. Christ kept his eyes on that finish line. And he endured the pain and the agony of his crucifixion and everything that led up to it on that cross because he saw that as crossing the finish line. He knew it was over. He knew he had won the race. But what did he see on the other side of the cross, if you will, that brought him joy? He said it brought him joy to sit there and suffer on that cross. We just read it. The answer is here in Hebrews 2. Look at Hebrews 2. Let's begin in verse 9. Hebrews 2, verse 9. But we see Jesus, who is made a little lower than the angels for the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that he, by the grace of God, might taste death for everyone. Again, summarizing Jesus' relationship with us. And here's our answer in verse 10. For it was fitting for him, for whom are all things, and by whom are all things, in bringing many sons to glory, to make the captain of their salvation perfect through sufferings. He saw you and me making it into God's kingdom. That's what Jesus Christ saw as joy. He envisioned in his mind, if I do this, if I die on this cross, if I go through all this agony, every person out there and every person that I've not even seen yet, that's not been born yet, every person that was born prior to them, every single human being will be given the opportunity to march into the kingdom of God. And Jesus Christ said, that's worth it to me. I'm going to do this. I'm going to accomplish this. I'm going to finish the race. It's almost that internally he was almost smiling, knowing that what he was doing was leading to mankind being able to make it into God's kingdom. To make the captain of their salvation perfect through sufferings, it says. Jesus Christ knew that if he suffered that pain, died there on that cross, one, he would see you and me make it into God's kingdom. And two, he would become the perfect leader through that suffering. He saw us making it into God's kingdom, just like we read about the joy of Paul and the people, knowing that the people were making the progress. That brought joy to Paul's spirit, Paul's heart. Go over to Galatians 2 real quick. Galatians chapter 2. Galatians used a few more pages back. I think I referred to this passage in Galatians 2 recently in that sermon that I gave on joy busters. If you can go back to the moment that you were baptized and recall it baptism, we were in a sense, and we were probably told, if not referenced to, we were crucified with Christ. That's the concept that is being brought out in the Bible. And he is the one who is now living in our lives. He's the one that lives in us. That's the whole concept of baptism. Allowing yourself to be crucified with him, burying the old self, coming out knowing that he, Jesus Christ, is living in us. All that power, all that energy, all that capacity is there for us to tap into. He bought us with his life. He owns us. Christ knew that we now have the power living in us, the power of the Holy Spirit. He knows it's there. He knows that if we tap into it, we can accomplish the exact same thing that he accomplished. We can finish the race. Let's look at one verse here in Galatians 2, verse 20. Galatians 2, verse 20. Paul writes here again, he says, I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. And the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. Let's go to Luke 14. Luke chapter 14. Luke 14. You know, when you think about it, Jesus Christ basically postponed his joy. It's not unlike those we read about in Hebrews 11. They died and they didn't receive the promise. Remember it says back in Hebrews 11, they just saw it afar off. They could visualize it, make it real to them. So did Jesus Christ see us. He visualized, he saw us afar off, making it into God's kingdom. As he hung there on that cross, suffering. Seeing us in the future is what brought Jesus Christ joy. Like Jesus Christ, we have to endure the race. As he told us here in Luke 14, we must be willing to take up our own crosses for the future joy that is set before us, God's kingdom and eternal life. Let's look at Luke 14 beginning in verse 25. Luke 14, verse 25. Now great multitudes went with him, and he turned and said to them, If anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, his own life also, he cannot be my disciples. We've got to come to the point of loving Jesus Christ first and foremost above anything else in this life. And whoever does not bear his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. It doesn't get any plainer than that. He said, I did it for you, now you can do it for me. Not that we have to hang on a cross like he did, at least I don't think most of us are ever going to do that. Let's go back to Hebrews 12 again. Hebrews 12. As we just read in Luke 14, we are now linked together. We are now linked together with Jesus Christ via the cross. Christ's and ours. These burdens, which is what that cross represents, these burdens in life make us a part of Jesus Christ in a very real way. Every time you suffer, every time you have a pain, every time you have a trial, every time you have a difficulty, every time you have a challenge, every time something doesn't go right in your life, it's a connection. You're just like Christ. He said, I want you to understand that. You're bearing your own cross. You're just like me. And you're going to finish just like me. It's the perspective that he wants us to get. Paul sort of wraps this whole point up for us here in Hebrews 12 and verse 3. He reminds us that Jesus Christ endured the cross, as he mentioned, and also endured the hostility for sinners, from sinners. Not unlike us. Jesus Christ endured the cross from sinners because it said he died while we were still sinning. And yet we are asked and called to run this race with endurance. There's nothing expected from us. There is nothing expected from us that Jesus Christ hasn't already accomplished. Not one thing. And he did it in the flesh. He did it as a human being to show us it can be done. Hebrews 12, verse 3 now. Hebrews 12, verse 3. For consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. You have not resisted yet to bloodshed, striving against sin. Then you read that, it doesn't come out totally clear. Let me reread those two verses again from the New Living Translation. You can follow along or just listen. I think it brings clarity to these two verses. This is what it says in the New Living Translation. Think of all the hostility he endured from sinful people. Then you won't become weary and give up when it's happening to you. It happened to him, it's going to happen to you. After all, you have not yet given your lives in your struggle against sin. You haven't been asked to die yet. Every struggle, every pain, every agony is a direct connection to Christ. It means you're going through what he went through in your own way. Brethren, we have seen here in these first few verses of Hebrews 12, our life is about doing the hard things, even when we prefer not to do them. We go forward in our race because we have some great examples from our past. And we have a great leader, Jesus Christ, leading us today. Paul has been trying to use Jesus Christ on the heels of biblical ancestry, as described in Hebrews 11, to encourage us to finish strong. Keep moving forward in this race of life. Christ doesn't want us to become weary and give up. He said, when you can't do it, I'll take care of it. When you physically can't do it, I will take care of it. When you spiritually can't do it, I will take care of it. I will step in where you need help every single step of the way. He wants us to run with commitment. He wants us to run with endurance. And we've been just reminded that the joy of crossing the finish line is worth it. Paul's trying to convey it. Jesus Christ is trying to convey it. And all of those examples of Hebrews 11 were trying to convey that. Jesus Christ led the way and is telling us, follow me and finish strong. Have a great Sabbath.